I'm going to go through the story of Paul's travel to Rome with you this morning. I guess we could call the lesson Paul's harrowing voyage to Rome. And we're going to look at the geography involved and some historical notes that will shed some light on this. And then after that, there are three lessons that I think that we can derive from this story that will benefit us spiritually in our walk with God. And I'm going to take my Bible, and what I'm going to first of all do is just kind of set the stage. You'll remember that in the book of Acts, we see Peter preaching to the Jews, and then after Peter opens the door to the Gentiles, Paul becomes a Christian and an apostle, and he is the apostle to the Gentiles. And we read about Paul's travels in the book of Acts. And as he goes about, he's especially traveling up in this area, which would be modern-day Turkey, and then this area, Macedonia, and down into Greece on his journeys. And there are three major journeys that are recorded in the book of Acts. And on the third one, when he gets all the way over here into Greece, he is collecting money from Gentile Christians especially, up here and up here and over here, to take back to Jerusalem for the purpose of helping the impoverished Christians in Jerusalem. Gentile Christians helping Jewish Christians. He comes back in Acts chapter 21 to Jerusalem with these monies, and he meets the Jewish brethren in Jerusalem. He meets James, who is a leader in the church at Jerusalem, and the elders, and they're really glad to see him, but they have a concern. And their concern is, Paul, the saints here in Jerusalem, Jewish believers, are very zealous for the law. In other words, even though they've become Christians, they still keep the Sabbath, they still observe many of the aspects of the law of Moses. They've heard people say that you are out there telling Jewish Christians they can't keep the Sabbath. They cannot circumcise their children. And this is going to create a problem. Can you do something? They advised him, can you participate in one of these Jewish rituals with the Jews to let them know that you're not telling them they cannot continue in their customary Jewish ways? And so Paul does that. And he goes down to the temple. It's part of the process of what he's going to be doing here. And there were some Jews at the temple from Ephesus up here. Jews down here in Jerusalem from up here. They had seen Paul in the city the previous day with a man named Trophimus, who was from Ephesus. And for some reason, they got it in their heads that Paul had taken this Gentile into the Jewish temple. Now, you'll remember there was a court on the outside or on the outer parts of the temple grounds where Gentiles were allowed to go. But there was a barrier beyond which they could not go, and there were signs up warning them of death if they crossed those barriers. That's apparently what these Jews have accused Paul of doing, of taking a Gentile into the inner courts of the temple where Gentiles were not supposed to go. And so, sure enough, they're going to beat him and probably would have beaten him to death. But Claudius Lysias, the Roman captain in charge here, trying to keep order, comes down to see what's going on, what the commotion is about, takes the man in the center of it into custody. That would be Paul. He doesn't know who Paul is. He thinks Paul is maybe some assassin or something. Comes to find out Paul is not an assassin. And he allows Paul the opportunity to turn around and speak to the Jewish people. And so Paul does. And they listen to him when he starts preaching to them in Hebrew, telling them the story of Jesus, up until he says something about Jesus sending him, Paul, to preach to the Gentiles. At that point, they didn't want to hear it. And so Claudius Lysias, all right, so he takes Paul into custody, and he arranges to have Paul go before the council, the Sanhedrin of the Jews. And there, you may remember the story that takes place there. Paul kind of divides and conquers the Sadducees and the Pharisees on the issue of the resurrection. But that doesn't get him anywhere as far as Claudius Lysias resolving in his mind what's going on here. And then there's a plot to kill Paul. And so Claudius Lysias sends Paul from Jerusalem up to Caesarea to the charge of Felix, who is in the similar office that Pontius Pilate had previously held. And he sends with him a letter explaining what this is all about. So Paul has an opportunity to talk to Felix about the gospel of Jesus Christ. And Felix listens, but he's more interested in thinking he can get some money from Paul. Remember, what did Paul come to Jerusalem with? A bunch of money. And so he keeps him for 2 years until his term is up. And then Felix is replaced by Festus. And Festus comes down here to Jerusalem shortly after coming into office. And the Jews bring their accusations about Paul to Festus. And Festus says, well, I'll be back in Caesarea. You come up there and I'll hear the case. So he goes back to Caesarea, and the Jews go up there to Caesarea, and they bring their accusations, and they don't get anywhere, and they say, well, send him back down to Jerusalem. And Festus says, well, Paul, are you willing to go back down to Jerusalem? Well, Paul knows what's up. He knows that there's this plot out to kill him. So he says, no, you know what? If that's the way it's going to be, I'll just appeal to Caesar. And he had that right, because he's a Roman citizen. And that's what Phil just read to us a moment ago. He appeals to Caesar, and Festus, well, that gets it out of my hands. Okay, then you'll go to Caesar. Meanwhile, Herod Agrippa shows up, and Festus tells him about it, and then they decide they both want to listen to Paul. So Paul has an opportunity to preach to Festus and Herod Agrippa, and at the end of it, Herod Agrippa says, you know what? This guy hadn't done anything wrong. He could have been released except for the fact that he's appealed to Caesar. Yep, too bad he appealed to Caesar. And so he's going to go to Rome. And that brings us to Acts chapter 28. Acts chapter 28, verse 1. Acts chapter 27, verse 1. Acts chapter 27, verse 1. When it was determined that we should sail for Italy, they delivered Paul and certain other prisoners to a centurion named Julius of the Augustan band. And embarking in a ship of Adramidium, which was about to sail unto the places on the coast of Asia, we put to sea, Aristarchus, a Macedonian of Thessalonica, being with us. There are three things there we want to make note of. First of all, this is in the autumn of AD 58. That's not one of the three things, but that's where we are. In the fall of AD 58. So we're about 30, well, not quite, maybe 25 years, 25 to 30 years after the crucifixion of Jesus. And there's a ship of Adramidium bound for Asia here in the Caesarean port. Adramidium is up here, and that's the home base of this ship. And this ship is headed that direction to Asia. Asia in the Bible means this area right here. It's a name of a Roman province there on the west end of what would be modern-day Turkey. It's kind of interesting that the Bible mentions that there was Aristarchus traveling with Paul. How often when you guys get arrested do you get to bring a friend along with you? Does that happen with you? Not only is Aristarchus there with him, but notice the way it's written. It says at the end of verse 2, Aristarchus, a Macedonian of Thessalonica, being with us. Who's writing this? Luke is writing this. So Luke is going along for the ride too. Well, that's kind of interesting. Pliny the Younger wrote about something that'll help us here a little bit. Pliny the Elder, and I mention this for a reason, I hope to come back to in a moment. Pliny the Elder was a man who was killed at Pompeii when Mount Vesuvius blew up in AD 79, if I remember correctly, so just about 20 years after these events. He had a nephew, who we know as Pliny the Younger, who lived at the end of the first century and into the beginning of the second century. And he wrote a lot of letters to Trajan, the Roman emperor, at the beginning of the second century or into the first part of the second century. In some of his writings, he described a situation about a guy named Paetus who was being sent to Rome by ship as a prisoner, kind of like Paul, whose wife wanted to accompany him and who therefore reasoned with the people in charge. As he is of consular rank, this Paetus, you'll assign him some servants to serve his meals, to valet him and put on his shoes. When you get arrested, do they assign you some servants to take care of you while you're in the huskow? Do they do that? Well, that's what she's saying. You're going to do that. I'll perform all these offices for him. She's wanting to get to go along, and she's saying, just let me be one of his attendants. Well, they refused her request, but her request attests to the practice of allowing a Roman citizen of some rank to be accompanied by attendants when being transported as a prisoner to Rome. It's interesting, as we go through this whole story of Paul's trip to Rome, Paul seems to have a lot of clout. He talks about where they should port and where they should spend the winter and all of this kind of thing. Prisoners don't usually have that kind of clout, but this is a little different situation than when you and I get arrested. All right, in case you're visiting here, we don't customarily get arrested, but you never know the way things are going. So the ship sails, but it only makes just a one-day hop up to Sidon, and Paul is allowed to go in. Let's back up here. Paul is allowed to go in and visit some friends there at Sidon. Pretty good treatment for a prisoner. And after that, they head on up. Verse 4 says, "From there we put out to sea and sailed under the shelter of Cyprus." This is Cyprus right here, because the winds were contrary. So under the lee or under the shelter of Cyprus means that they got to go around the east and around the north side. Apparently the wind's coming from west to east. And so they're going to go up this way, and they come to Myra up here on the southern coast of what would be modern day Turkey. And then we come to verse 6, and we read about a ship of Alexandria being there at the port in Myra, and it was bound for Italy. And so Alexandria is down here. So you can see this ship would have been making a travel like this up to here with the idea, you would assume, of scooting across like this over here to Italy. And so they're going to hop in that ship. And it says in verse 7, "When we had sailed slowly," notice how slowly the ship is moving, "for a good many days and with difficulty and had arrived off Cnidus, since the wind did not permit us to go further." They're having trouble making any kind of progress as they go. Now remember, they're trying to get to Italy, so presumably they just want to scoot right along like this, hopping along through these islands along the coast. But they're having difficulty because of the wind. And so, verse 7 says, "We sailed under the shelter of Crete off Salmone." I'm not sure how to say that. And there's a port there on the south side, Fair Haven, and that's where they stopped. And they get down here to Fair Haven in verse 9. Luke says, "When much time was spent and the voyage was now dangerous because the fast was now already gone by." That would refer to the Day of Atonement or Yom Kippur. And that would probably be, well, late October, which means that by the time we are at in this story, we're past the good travel season. Now we're into the season when the seas can be very rough. They don't need to be out traveling anymore. They tried to get their seafaring trips done before this time of year. So Paul admonished them. This is the prisoner. Admonishing them, verse 10, said to them, "Sirs, I perceive that the voyage will be with injury and much loss, not only of the lading in the ship, but also of our lives." I want you to remember what he said. "I perceive that we're going to lose cargo and our lives if we keep going. We need to stay right here." But the master and the owner of the ship disagreed. They wanted to go just a little bit further because the port at Fair Haven was not very good. They want to scoot over just a little bit further to the west to winter at Phoenix, to spend the winter there. So there was a soft wind that blew up, according to verse 13, when the south wind blew softly, supposing that they had obtained their purpose to just scoot along the coast to the west and come up to Phoenix, they set sail and sailed along Crete close inshore. But verse 14 says, "Before very long, there rushed down from the land a violent wind called Euroquilo. And when the ship was caught in it and could not face the wind, we gave way to it and let ourselves be driven along, running under the shelter of a small island called Clauda," or your Bible may say Cauda. "We were scarcely able to get the ship's boat under control." The ship's boat. The ship had a little boat that it would tow behind. It'd be a landing craft, that kind of thing. And you got a storm going on, you're trying to navigate through, you don't want to be towing along this little ship behind. So they hauled it up. And after they'd hoisted it up, they used supporting cables in undergirding the ship and fearing that they might run aground on the shallows of Sirtis. They let down the sea anchor. That expression, the sea anchor, is one that's debated. Some think it means sea anchor. Some think it means the sails. Some think it means sea anchor. They think that they threw this anchor out into the water that they would drag in the water to slow them down because they don't want to end up in the Syrtis. Others think that it means they lowered the sails to reduce the effect of the wind blowing on them so that they would not go crashing into the Syrtis. And in this way, let themselves be driven along. What's the Syrtis? The Syrtis. Here's the Euroquillo blowing them toward the Syrtis. Well, the Syrtis is down here on the North African coast. There's the greater Syrtis, and here's the lesser Syrtis. It's these bays here on the North African coast. And these were legendary. Strabo was a geographer in the late 1st century B.C. and the early 1st century A.D. In other words, about the time Jesus would have been young. And he writes about the great Syrtis and the lesser Syrtis, and he talks about their dimensions. And starting right there, the difficulty with both this Syrtis and the little Syrtis is that in many places their deep waters contain shallows. And the result is that the ebb and flow of the tides, the sailors sometimes fall into the shallows and stick there. The boat sticks there, not just the... And that the safe escape of a boat is rare. On this account, sailors keep at a distance when voyaging along the coast, taking precautions not to be caught off their guard and driven by winds into these gulfs. Well, that's exactly what's happening. Their ship is being driven by the wind, by the Euroquillo, right toward the Syrtis. So you can imagine, you're out there, you've got deep water, you're totally unaware that you're coming upon an area under the water where there's a shallow. You can't see it. Maybe at low tide, you're down close enough to it to get stranded on it, but you're miles from shore. You run your ship onto that, you're not going anywhere. And they just died. So that's the concern. There's another writing, this from the 3rd century before Christ. Jason and the Argonauts. Apollonius wrote about this. And Jason and the Argonauts were sailing down here. And even then, a baleful blast of the north wind seized them in mid-course and swept them towards the Libyan Sea. 9 nights and as many days, till they came far within Syrtis, wherefrom is no return for ships when they are once forced into that gulf. So it was legendary, the Syrtis was. And you can imagine the panic as these sailors on the ship are being driven by the storm right toward the Syrtis. And they're doing everything they can to avoid getting cast upon the Syrtis. Just by the way, for what it's worth, how many of you, if I say Benghazi, does that ring a bell? Benghazi, right there. It moves around a lot. It kind of sometimes is... Anyway, it's right there. So, on the first day as they're fighting this storm, they secured the landing boat. We've already read about that. And they undergirded the ship. That's kind of interesting, undergirding the ship. A book called Ships and Seamanship in the Ancient World by Lionel Casson says the technique of frapping a ship, that is passing heavy cables under the keel during bad weather in order to reinforce provisionally a weakened hull, is known from at least the 1st century A.D. Well, that's the century we're talking about. And lasted as long as the wooden sailing ship. The most celebrated example is the time when St. Paul's vessel was struck by a gale and the sailors used helps to undergird the ship. Kind of like just putting big belts around the hull of the ship to hold it together so it wouldn't break up. They're really worried about what this storm could do to them. The second day, they threw the freight overboard. The third day, they threw the equipment overboard. And then, verse 27 says, when the 14th night came, so they've been out there 2 weeks now, as we were being driven about in the Adriatic Sea, about midnight, the sailors began to surmise that they were approaching some land. Adriatic Sea, you all thought this was the, where is it? You all thought this was what sea? You all thought that was the Mediterranean, didn't you? Why did it say Adriatic? Well, so... right there, going up between Turkey and Greece, would be the Aegean Sea. And this one here, sticking up here, is the Adriatic Sea. But in some of these ancient writings, they speak of the age, they, instead of thinking of it horizontally, Mediterranean and little bays up here, they thought of this as the Adriatic all the way coming down like this. And so that says Sea of Adria right there under that. So, about midnight, the sailors began to surmise that they were approaching some land. So they started taking soundings. And we go to Acts chapter 27, verse 28. They sounded and found 20 fathoms. I've never actually seen this done, but I gather, I have the impression it would be kind of, you have a long rope with knots in it every so often, and at the bottom a weight. And you throw that weight over, and when it hits bottom, then you count how many knots. And for each of those knots, that's a measure. And then you figure out how deep the water is there. And when they did it the first time, they found 15 fathoms. So a fathom is about 6 feet. So 15 times, no, they did it the first time, they found 20 fathoms. So 20 times 6 would be 120 feet deep. And the next time, they found 15 fathoms. So now we're about 90 feet deep. If it's 120 feet deep, and then it's 90 feet deep, the next time it might be 60, and the next time it might be 30, and the next time you're hitting something, and it's dark, it's night. So they can't see. Now you're on a ship being driven by a storm, and the water's getting shallower and shallower and shallower, and it's dark. Oh! So what do you do? Well, let's read what they did. Starting in verse 29. Fearing lest haply we should be cast ashore on rocky ground, they let go 4 anchors from the stern and wished for day. And as the sailors were seeking to flee out of the ship and had lowered the boat into the sea under color, as though they would lay out anchors from the foreship, they're going to get this little boat and crank it down. And they set it up so it looked like we're just going to go put anchors out off the bow. They're really trying to escape. Paul said to the centurion and to the soldiers, this is the prisoner, says to the centurion and the soldiers, except these abide in the ship, you cannot be saved. And the soldiers cut away the ropes of the boat and let her fall off. And then they go on and I forgot something I'll come back to later. I'll come back to it in just a moment. We'll wrap this up here in a moment. But they eat, and then after that, they decide to throw everything overboard, and they cast off the anchors, and the boat breaks up, and anybody could swam for shore, and anybody who couldn't grabbed hold of something and floated to shore, and they end up on this island of Melita or Malta, where they were close to it. Now, the next story is about a snake in chapter 28. It's cold and rainy and they need to make a fire, and Paul gathered a bundle of sticks and laid them on the fire, and a viper comes out because of the heat and bit him. And the local people, it says barbarians in this translation, saw the venomous creature in verse 4, 28:4, hanging from his hand, and they said one to another, no doubt this man is a murderer who though he has escaped from the sea, yet justice hath not suffered to live. Howbeit, he shook off the creature into the fire and took no harm. They expected that he would have done what? Swollen or fallen down dead when? Suddenly. But when they were long in expectation and beheld nothing amiss come to him, they changed their minds and said that he was a god. All right. And the problem is there are no venomous snakes on Malta. And so this is a question. What kind of snake bit Paul? There are various explanations that are offered. One is that, well, whatever venomous snakes used to be on Malta became extinct. But there's no history, there's no record, there's no remains, there's no fossils, there's no written records of there having been such snakes. So people doubt that. And other people say, well, maybe this was an isolated specimen, an isolated snake that got carried in with the cargo from some ship or drifted in on driftwood. And so it's just the only poisonous snake on Malta, and it got Paul. But the locals knew this snake and what to expect from its bite. That sounds like it's not like they've never seen this snake before, this kind of snake. So another explanation that somebody has offered is this is the wrong island. It should be Melita, which is also known as Mljet, something like that, M-L-J-E-T. I don't know how you say that. And it's interesting because that island has snakes. This is a snake found in the Adriatic. I don't know how you say that. Vipera, let's just say viper, Amidites, something like that. It's a venomous viper, this is from Wikipedia, species found in southern Europe through to the Balkans, which is that peninsula that comes down toward Greece. In parts of the Middle East, it is reputed to be the most dangerous of the European vipers due to its large-sized fangs, long fangs, up to 13 meters. 13 millimeters, but it's just right. And high venom toxicity. This is likely the most dangerous snake to be found in Europe. In some areas, it is at least a significant medical risk. We'll skip that next paragraph and go down to the bottom paragraph. Bites promote symptoms typical of viperid envenomation, such as pain, swelling. What did they think Paul would have done? Swelled up. Discoloration, all of which may be immediate. They thought he'd fall down suddenly. Remember that? There are also reports of dizziness and tingling. Humans respond rapidly to this venom, as do mice and birds. Well, the island, Melita, was so heavily infested with the notorious horned viper, Vipera amidites, that a predatory mongoose was introduced on the island in 1910 to control the snake population. Here's the problem with that. It doesn't make sense geographically. Here is Malta, where we believe Paul shipwrecked. Here is this other island. Now remember, they were traveling from here, almost got thrown onto the Syrtis, and then navigated through the strait here, up here, all the way up there. And then the text says then after that they go to Syracuse, which is here, on their way to Rome. If they're here, why not just hop right over to here? They're actually going to end up at Puteoli. They're not going to sail all the way to Rome. If they're going to travel the land from here to here, why not just travel straight across here and then go here? That doesn't make sense geographically. I think a better explanation is there were some of these snakes. The snakes are in the region, and some arrived at this island of Malta from cargo from ships. Maybe a sufficient number to be known to the locals, but insufficient number to become a thriving population and leave a footprint historically, and they ended up becoming extinct. Now, I don't know if that's the right explanation, but it makes sense to me. Well, anyway, they wintered there for 3 months. So they were, trying to spend the winter back here, and they end up spending the winter here. So now we are in A.D. 59. And verse 11 of 28 says, at the end of 3 months, we set sail on the Alexandrian ship which had wintered at the island and which had the twin brothers for its figurehead. And they sailed up to Syracuse, spent 3 days there. Verse 13, from there we sailed around and arrived at Rhegium. And a day later, a south wind sprang up. And on the second day, we came to Puteoli. And this is interesting because I mentioned Pompeii earlier, where Pliny the Elder died. In 79, Pompeii is very close to Puteoli, and there are records of about that time of the people in Pompeii having curiosity about these strange Christians. Anyway, there Paul gets off the boat, makes his way up. There we found some brethren. We're invited to stay with them for 7 days at Puteoli. Thus we came to Rome. And the brethren, when they'd heard about us, came from there as far as the market of Appius, which is right there, and three inns. Three taverns, and to meet us. And when Paul saw them, he thanked God and took courage. And when we entered Rome, Paul was allowed to stay by himself with the soldier who was guarding him. All right, that's three quick lessons I want to draw from all of this. One, speaking by one's own wisdom versus speaking by revelation. If we go back to the account in Acts chapter 27, in Acts chapter 27, Paul said, verse 10, "Sirs, I perceive that the voyage will be with injury and much loss, not only of the lading in the ship, but also of our lives." What did Paul say? We're going to die. But as they are on their way to the Syrtis, we come down to verse 22, and Paul says, "Now I exhort you to be of good cheer." Everybody, cheer up. "For there shall be no loss of life." What did he say earlier? We're going to die. Now what does he say? "There'll be no loss of life among you, but only of the ship. For there stood by me this night an angel of the God whose I am, whom also I serve, saying, fear not, Paul, thou must stand before Caesar, and lo, God has granted thee all them that sail with thee." The first time, Paul was just perceiving. Looks like to me, if we keep sailing, we're going to die. And then an angel of God speaks to him and says, there's going to be no loss of life. And the point I want to simply make is, that there's a difference between even for a godly man who knows his Bible well, there's a difference between speaking what his own wisdom leads him to conclude and speaking the Word of God. We need to pay attention to that. You know, we can develop great confidence in somebody. Here's a good man. He knows his Bible. But if he's not quoting the Bible, I can regard what he's saying and consider it, but it's not the same as if it's the Word of God. In 1 Peter chapter 4, verse 11, if any man speaks, let him speak as the oracles of God. We need to make that distinction. And then the second point I want to make is good news, but oh, by the way, we're going to be shipwrecked. It's what Paul says in verse 22. He says, "Now I exhort you to be of good cheer. Nobody's going to die. The angel stood before me, told me that I've got to get to Rome and everything's going to turn out all right. Verse 26, but we must be cast upon a certain island." There are a lot of times in life where we need to realize good news is coming, but I got to go through some difficulties first. In the Old Testament, the Israelites leaving Egypt for the Promised Land, a land described as flowing with milk and honey. But what do they have to go through on the way? Times when they're thirsty, times when they don't have any food. And God's going to take care of them. And then eventually they're going to get out there, and because of their lack of faith, they're going to find out they're going to have to go through 40 years in the wilderness. But good news. There's a Promised Land that awaits you, but you're going to go through some hard times first. In Revelation chapter 2 and verse 10, it says, writing to the angel of the church at Smyrna, "Fear not the things which you are about to suffer. Behold, the devil is about to cast some of you into prison, that you may be tried, and you shall have tribulation 10 days. Be thou faithful unto death." You're going to go through some difficult times. You may even get killed. But you do have good news awaiting you. The one who was dead and is alive again tells you that he'll give you the crown of life. So there's an application to ourselves that we can make. We have good news awaiting us. In between the consummation of all things and now, we may go through some very hard times. We need to stay focused on the good news and get through those hard times and not be turned aside by the hard times. Some little personality conflict in the congregation. I lose my job. Preacher says something that hurts my feelings. Marital problems, whatever. All those things can be difficult and discouraging, but let's not let those things cause us to lose our focus on what lies ahead and cause us to act differently than we would based on what lies ahead. And the last point is simply this. Being a servant of God, not only after coming through that trial that lies between now and the good news, but during that trial. You think about Paul as we see him on this ship and his conduct. Do you get any impression that the people would have failed to see Paul as a servant of God based on his conduct? You know, Paul's going through the same difficulties as everybody else. Paul's in danger of being cast upon the Sirtis. Paul's the one that got bit by the snake. Paul was shipwrecked like all the rest of them. But every indication is Paul conducted himself as a servant of God through all of that. People could see that. We go through difficulties and sometimes we excuse ourselves. We'll even excuse somebody else. Some of the brethren will come and talk to us and we'll say, "Yeah, I know. I'm just going through some really hard times right now." They're saying, "Listen, you need to be more faithful. You need to not be missing assemblies of the church. You need to keep your spiritual focus." "Yeah, I know I should, but I'm going through some hard times right now." And when we're going through the hard times, that's not an excuse to quit serving God. We need to keep focused on the good thing that's coming. Paul had more to endure when he got to Rome. Getting to Rome is not the end of the road for him. When he gets to Rome, what's he going to be? He's going to be a prisoner. We don't know exactly how long he stayed a prisoner in Rome. In the book of Acts, we know that at least for 2 years, he's a prisoner in chains in Rome. Now, he is in a rented house, and he's allowed to have visitors, but he's in chains. And what did he do with that? Well, over in Philippians chapter 1, verses 12 through 14, he's writing as a prisoner from Rome to the church at Philippi, and here's what he says. I would have you know, brethren, that the things which happened unto me have fallen out rather unto the progress of the gospel. So that my bonds became manifest in Christ throughout the whole Praetorian Guard. He is talking to the guards about the gospel. And all the rest. And that most of the brethren in the Lord, being confident through my bonds, are more abundantly bold to speak the word of God without fear. I don't have it on screen, but I'll also call your attention to Philippians 4 in verse 22, where he says this to the Philippian brethren. All the saints salute you, especially they that are of Caesar's household. I wonder how it came to be that some of Caesar's household became Christians. While Paul is here, a runaway slave, Onesimus, comes to him. And in the book of Philemon, we read about him. And it's in verse 10. It says, well, where's Philemon? I thought it was after Hebrews. It's before Hebrews. Verse 10. I beseech thee for my child whom I have begotten in my bonds, Onesimus. So the point is, even when we're going through hardships, difficulties, rather than using that as an excuse to be less faithful to the Lord, let's see that we can be a servant of God during the trial, knowing that there's good news that awaits us. That's the lesson for this morning. Let's stand and sing the song that has been picked.